This is Jim Engster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana, signature support from the Mayor's Office of East Baton Rouge Parish, and the show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. Robin Dow producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. We start with baseball great Denny McClain. As we know, the last man to win 30 games in a season. His career was short, only a decade in the majors, but he played against and with some of the best players in the history of the game. And one of those was Willie Howard Mays Jr., who died 2 days ago at 93. And he was an electric presence in baseball, majors from 1951 to 1973. Jason Gay writes in the Wall Street Journal today, Mays was Showtime before Showtime, a World Series winner in 1954, rival to Mickey in the Bronx and Duke in Brooklyn, a superstar east-west and all parts in between. He bridged baseball generations and accelerated an integrating game. And he was born in Westfield, Alabama, May 6, 1931. He died in Palo Alto, California, June 18, 2024. Number 24 gone in the year of 2024. And Denny McClain, before he won those 31 games in 1968, he was the starting pitcher for the American League All-Star team in 1966 at Busch Stadium. And the leadoff batter was a guy named Willie Mays. And Denny McClain's pitching opponent that day was one Sandy Koufax. Good morning, Mr. McClain.
Good morning, James. How are you, buddy?
Doing well. Well, you, as I mentioned, you rub shoulders and you, of course, pitched against Willie Mays, but that had to be quite a heady experience for a kid from Markham, Illinois.
Yeah, it was. It was the All-Star game was something spectacular. That was my first one. I was just barely 21, I think, 21 or 22. And here I was surrounded by, forget the National League for a minute, but the American League, Kaline and McCarver, not McCarver, Freehan and Brooks Robinson, you know, Sandy Koufax for the National League and
well,
what have you.
And I mentioned Mays was the leadoff batter. Batting second was Roberto Clemente. Hitting third was
Hank Aaron.
Fourth, Willie McCovey. And fifth, Ron Santo. All Hall of Famers. You did pretty well that day, as I recall.
You know what? It was a pretty good day. It was. Let me tell you the story about Mays. I had never pitched against him before. Of course, I was only in the big leagues at that point in time, a couple of years. And here I was starting an All-Star game with 50,000 people. And I mean, I was overwhelmed. I mean, as a matter of fact, when Sam Mealy, who was the manager at the time from Minnesota, had his pre-game warm-up talk, I was the only one in the room that jumped up and down, and I yelled, "Go get him! Let's get him!" And I was the only guy in the middle of 50 people that said anything. And Freehan, who's sitting next to me, says, "Hey, calm down, calm down. You got to calm down. You'll never get through warming up." So went out there to warm up. Then about 30 minutes later, before I did that, I sat next to Koufax for 30 minutes. We had a 30-minute conversation about pitching, about general things that you know, guys just sit around and talk about, and how impressive the All-Star game was, and every year it got better. I mean, when he said that, I'm thinking, boy, would I like to do this twice. So he was just unbelievable with the conversation we held, and we became good friends. But Mays, I got to tell you, this was looking down at home plate. Remember now, I was born in 44, so Mays has been a superstar for quite some time before I got there. And I mean, this was in awe. And the guys you just named, all Hall of Famers, all great players, not just mediocre. Look, like, I think we're throwing in some mediocre Hall of Famers right now. I don't think some of the guys were, I think they were just on the edge of being in the Hall of Fame, and somehow, some way, somebody pushed them over. Anyway, Mays comes up. First pitch of the game, I throw him a fastball right down the middle. He takes it, and what he's trying to do, just like all the good hitters the first time around, they'll try to gauge your speed, and then they gauge, can you throw two strikes in a row? So I got him. I think I had him 0-2 or 1-2, and worked the count to 3-2. Now, before we went out, Freehan said, "Remember now, people are coming to see the other guys in the team too, He said, so not, let's not try to fool anybody. Let him at least swing at the ball. Let him at least hit the ball someplace. But whatever you do, don't go out there with the greatest stuff you've had in the world today. They'll boo you because everybody wants to see Willie Mays hit a home run and Aaron and everybody else. So we got we get Willie 3-2. And I haven't thrown a curveball for a strike all season long. Honest to God, I had the worst curveball when I first got there in the history of Major League Baseball. And I honest to God, I never threw one for a strike. And so Freehand puts down the sign for a curveball, and I'm thinking, what is he, nuts? Nuts, the first hitter of the game, and I'm supposed to be able to throw a strike with this curveball that I've got? And don't you know, I threw the best strike I've ever thrown in my life with a curveball, and Mays took it. Now, to finish this story, we did a lot of card shows together, Willie and I, a lot of card shows. And him and some of the other guys that you named, they were always at the shows, especially the early ones. And every time, and I can't use the language that Willie used all the time, but every time Willie was at a show and I was at the show, he would make a special effort to come over and say, hey, listen, you mother, blah, 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 blah. You didn't have to throw the curveball. I was ready for the fastball. So every time I saw him, he would remind me of my mother all the time.
Well, you, a listener notes, and we're here to talk primarily about Willie Mays, but we lost Hank Aaron last year, too, and people may not realize it, but in your last stint as a major league pitcher with the Atlanta Braves, your teammate was Henry Aaron.
Hank. Yeah. And I will tell you this, without anybody believing it or not believing it, Hank Aaron was the best hitter I ever saw. And you never hear this. He was the best hitter I ever saw. He could take a pitch within a 16th of an inch. I swear to you. And when I first got to Atlanta, somebody said, "Where do you see Aaron? Where do you see Aaron?" And I'll be gosh darn, this guy was. When you call balls and strikes, this guy never, ever, I swear to you, he never took a strike unless he wanted to. I never saw him be fooled in the number of times I saw him hit. He was some player, and he's never got his due. He's never really got his due, but he did so many things in the game of baseball for it, and some of the things that he advanced in the racist world was just incredible.
Well, and he broke the record of Babe Ruth. But
yep.
Mays
right.
played. He played in Candlestick, and he lost 2 years in the Korean War. Otherwise, he probably would have broken the record.
Yeah,
and I think Aaron was probably almost the equal, almost, but not quite. Mays and Mantle were the best players in the game, but Mays had a longer career, and and of course the Yankees had all that magic, but. When you were a kid, I suspect you were a Mickey Mantle guy.
Well, yeah, I was trying to sign with the Yankees. My mother, we had like 10 or 11 teams come to the house the day after I graduated from high school, and everybody came with the same check. So I know they talking to each other. Everybody had a check for $17,500, everybody. Now, the Yankees came, and they had a check also, the same check, same amount of money, and when it got down to cutting time, the guy said, "Well, listen, I've got this check here for you. You're ready to sign." And just as I was about to say, "Yeah, give me a pen," my mother cut me off, and she's because my dad had died a few years earlier from a heart attack, 36. And my mother said, "Now, could we think about this for a day or two?" What happened was my mother was this guy was dressed in an impeccable blue suit. The nice tie, the shoes, the whole thing. I mean, unbelievable how he was dressed. He drove up in a black Cadillac in the house. Now he's pitched me. I'm ready. I want to go play with Mickey Mantle. That was my idol growing up, Mickey Mantle. And lo and behold, my mother just said, "No, hang on a minute. We want to think about this." I said, so when the guy gets in his car and he drives away, I said, "What did you do? That's what I wanted. I wanted to play with the Yankees." She said, "Listen, didn't you see his shoes?" I said, "Mom, what do you mean, did I see his shoes?" He says, "He had a hole in a pair of shoes." I said, "Mom,
really?
What the hell is the hole got?" She says, "If he can't buy a new pair of shoes, you think their checks are good?"
And that's why you didn't become a Yankee. That's
the only reason I didn't become a Yankee.
What a great story. But Mays was one of those guys. He was a great center fielder, maybe the greatest. And he was a great base runner. He stole bases. He hit homers. He did everything well. He hit for average.
He did.
He was one of those, they call him a five-tool player. But he did it with such gusto and such enthusiasm that it was infectious.
You know the movie with John Travolta walking down the street in New York?
Staying Alive.
Every time I saw Mays.
Saturday Night Fever.
Every time I saw Mays later on in his life, he was still doing that, whatever, boogie-woogie, whatever the hell you want to call it. He still had that hump in his walk. He still had that strut. He still had the rhythm. I mean, he was just Willie Mays, and that was how we all identified him.
We'll take an 89.3-second break and return with the great Denny McLean after this. This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Dennis Dale McLean, and we're remembering Willie Mays, who died this week. He was the oldest Hall of Famer on the planet, 93 years old. And recently, this is a good observation from a listener, he got 10 more hits in his career because the stats from the Negro Leagues are now counted as official stats by Major League Baseball. He only played a few games, in fact, 13 games, but he did it when he was 17 years old. And today there is a game in Alabama, a Major League game, which was scheduled before the death of Mays, and he was from Alabama, as was Aaron and McCovey. This is something that Rickwood Field, Birmingham, Alabama, will be the site of a regular season game between the Cardinals and the Giants today. And Denny McLean, what do you make of, I think it's a good thing, but some people, purists, probably don't like it, the fact that the Negro League stats are now counted as Major League stats. Is that good?
Yeah, that's got to be controversial for a long time. I mean, it's certainly, I never saw the Negro Leagues play, so I'm not probably the best guy to say this, but I would think that the Major Leagues in baseball were somewhat better than the Negro Leagues. And I'm just assuming that because of the nature of our guys that we had up there, you know, the Babe Ruths and the Ty Cobbs and guys like that, the guys that got all the attention. So we'll never really know if they really were as good as they were. But if they certainly weren't as good as the American National League, they had to be very close because there's a lot of guys that went from the Negro Leagues to the Major Leagues. So it says something about the guys who played, and it says something about the way they trained, because if I look at their movies, and I don't get a lot out of the movies, but I get out of the movies that they were always in shape. I mean, they were versus our guys. You know, Babe Ruth loved 25 hot dogs a day. I didn't see anybody, the other guy.
Mickey Lolich.
Mickey Lolich, that's right.
Yeah,
I mean, all of those guys.
Well, but Mays was a force of nature, and he was a guy, as you know, who fought in a war and then couldn't come back to his home state and have dinner at certain places, many places. You faced that with Willie Horton, your teammate. Here was a guy.
We had a terrible event. We were in the minor leagues, and this was when I was in the minor leagues for a short time. We went to Lynchburg, West Virginia, had a baseball game, and Willie Horton got hit by a pitch. And Willie thought the guy threw at him on purpose, and it hit him in the bat handle, just above the bat handle, and broke him up pretty good. And he thought the pitcher was laughing at him. He thought the pitcher had thrown at him because Willie had hit a home run the time before. Well, Willie got so irritated with this, looked like this guy was arguing, that both benches emptied. All of a sudden, we had a fight on the field. Willie's trying to kill people. Literally, I mean, Willie just got out of hand that day. And they sent him to the locker room right away. I was on the disabled list at the time, so they sent me right after Willie to get up there. And I saw, and I'm born and raised in Chicago, folks. I mean, I've seen everything at least once in Chicago. When we talk about police forces and things like that, I had four uncles at one time in the Chicago police force. So I've got plenty of stories about the cops. But what I saw in West Virginia that day, and I'm certainly glad they've come a long way since then, is that the police followed him up to the locker room and had guns drawn when he went into the locker room and started, believe it or not, he started destroying the locker room. He picked up a bat and started banging everybody's locker and broke about a half a dozen of them. But he was in there alone. He was taking out his frustrations alone. He wasn't going after anybody. And they had guns drawn. They actually had guns drawn. And I suggest to you that if the guy was a white guy in there, it would have been a whole different world. They'd probably been trying to talk him down, for God's sakes. But boy, I'll tell you, and I kept yelling at Willie. I said, you better stop it. We got trouble here. And I forget what else I said, but I said a lot of nasty things to him, too. Well, and Willie wasn't the guy to get upset.
No, but he was a part of the 68 championship team. And
he sure was.
And he was a great player, and you were surrounded great by player. A lot of great ones. But I think it's fair to say we're associated with three of the greatest players in the history of the game. And Mays, who you pitched against, Henry Aaron, who was a teammate, and Ted Williams, who was your manager. And I remember Bobby Knight once saying that the amazing thing about Ted Williams was he not only was perhaps the greatest pure hitter of all time, but he also was a great pilot and he said the best fisherman he had ever met or been with. Well, Denny McClain and my friend Steve Myers noted this. The other day he was looking up great American organists, and there on the list was a guy named Denny McClain. And he said, is that the same guy? I said, yep, that's the same guy. People don't know that you're pretty good with a Hammond organ, weren't you?
Yeah.
And still are. Still play, don't you?
I still am. I'm still playing. Still working once in a while. And the thing with Ted Williams, the first thing, Ted, when he called me, said that I was being traded to the Washington Senators. First of all, it was the saddest day of my life. And then secondly, it was, he said, now listen, you're going to report the spring training on time the first day in March, and don't forget to bring your organ. I said, what? I said, what? What? Bring what? You know, so Ted had a little bit of a sense of humor. But I will tell you this about Ted. I'll make it short. I think we're probably short on time. But with Ted, we had a kid by the name of Pete Broberg who was out there trying to make the team.
Went to Dartmouth. Didn't he go to Dartmouth?
Went to Dartmouth. Yes, he did. So we signed him in Washington, and nobody can hit him in batting practice because the kid throws the ball, four of them behind you, three in the dirt. I mean, it looks like everybody's doing a rumba up there trying to stay out of the way of his fastball. Ted grabs a bat, and goes into the box. He says, you know, you guys are all a bunch of, I won't say the word, he says, you guys are all a bunch of wussies. And Ted said, here, I'll hit against him. The first pitch, this Broberg, this is the first strike he threw in 10 minutes. And Ted hit it off the right field wall. So we all bowed. Everybody bowed. Literally bowed to him when he hit the ball off the wall. He was something.
But as you know, great players are often not great managers. And he was
right.
He was a terrible manager, wasn't he?
Brutal, just brutal. The managers I played for always were three or four innings ahead in the game. You know, their thinking process. Ted would turn around and say, well, who have I got on the bench? Who didn't play today? Mm-hmm. You know, and guys would yell out names. Oh, Broberg, that about, you know, whoever might have been it. And I'll tell you one thing. It was the longest year of my life. And then I lose 20 ball games. Something I wasn't used to. But our guys, great, by the way, they were the greatest guys I ever played with. They had fun. They wanted to play every day. They wanted to win every day. But we just didn't have the guys to perform that well. And we wound up at the bottom, of course. But the worst thing was that when they announced that they were moving the Senators to Texas, man, we had to guard our houses. People got so mad up there. And then I asked, well, where the hell were the people all season long? They didn't come out to the ballpark, and now they're upset?
Well,
and somebody
that's
said,
the way it works.
But somebody then said, yeah, but those are the only three people that did come out.
Well, Denny McLean was a guy who was a workhorse, and of course he paid the part, paid the price because of his shoulder going out. But 1968, 336 innings, 1969, 325. Those are regular season totals, believe it or not. But a listener notes, and I'm quoting Ozzie Smith here, who said of Willie Mays, "I never really knew how great he was until I played in Candlestick. My God, what would have happened if he'd played in a real ballpark?" You played in a ballpark that was not charitable to pitchers, and people may not know it. He had an ERA under 2 in 68 with those 336 innings and allowed 31 home runs because that was a hitter-friendly park in Tiger Stadium, wasn't it?
Well, we were only 315 down the right field line, and we were, I think, 325 down the left field line. So if you're a pull hitter from either side, you got a shot at knocking the ball out. But our ballpark was, and it was painted in total black green. I mean, so the hitters had every advantage in our ballpark, and center field was 4.
It was very friendly to the hitters, but Denny was the best in the business. And he is still fun to talk to. Thank you, Denny. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana. Always a pleasure to catch up with Mark Ballard, and there's much to talk about with him. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 877-217-5757, and emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. Governor Jeff Landry has signed into law a bill requiring public schools and colleges in our state to post the Ten Commandments in every classroom. And he welcomes challenges to the law in court, and he's going to get it. There are already moves on that front. During a keynote speech in Tennessee over the weekend, Governor Landry touted the bill as a conservative victory in the ongoing culture wars. Now, Mark, I don't know if this will stand constitutional muster or not. It'll probably go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, but Governor Landry, for anybody who's surprised about this, they should have known that he is sincere in his beliefs, and there really is no shock that he's moving in this direction.
No, not at all. I think that I suspect that he looked at the way the Fifth Circuit is right now, and particularly the way the Supreme Court is right now, and feels that he has a good shot at actually winning this case when it gets into the high courts. So I also got to mention that that was pretty much the top story in this area, but none of the stories were portrayed Louisiana in a favorable light. Let's just say it that way.
Well, some people would say that's their problem, not ours. And there are some also who say, look, pick your battles, and this one is not something that is worth fighting for. But others say, look, it is significant, and of course it might be offensive to people who are not believers in a God or the Ten Commandments or a Christian God. And which version do we put? There are all kinds of wrinkles involved. But traditionally, the U.S. For many years now has held fast on the separation of church and state. Does this interfere with that separation? That will be the ultimate question of the court. But Jeff Landry believes it doesn't. I don't think he would purposely move something forward that he thought was going to die at the court level. But in the past, the odds would have been against him. You're saying that maybe with a new court, remember Donald Trump appointed three highly conservative justices, that it may very well make it.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable, and that's a reasonable assumption on their part. And it's not just the Supreme Court, but also the Fifth Circuit has skewed pretty much on a conservative basis. So it may have a fairly easy flight up. And I don't know. I think that Jeff Landry likes to pick fights. And so whether or not he thought he was going to win this or not, he just liked to get this one on the record. Is that the right word? I mean, you know, to get this going.
Well, when he was attorney general, he fought some battles at the court level at the expense of taxpayers that were not successful. And a listener notes that this could cost the state some money, I presume, even in victory.
Yeah, I imagine it will, because I imagine that they're going to have to get the the top lawyers involved in this, as well as Attorney General Murrell, and they don't come cheap. They have a high hourly wage.
But for those who are true believers, and I believe Governor Landry is one of those, this is a battle worth fighting, and he's not the first conservative politician to do this kind of thing. Remember George H.W. Bush in 1988, he actually recited the Pledge of Allegiance at the Republican National Convention to show up Michael Dukakis, who had vetoed a bill in Massachusetts making the Pledge of Allegiance mandatory. He thought that was inappropriate because of the mention of God. But this is an old battle with a new twist, and Jeff Landry is not afraid to get in the weeds and fight these kinds of fights. The question, I guess, beyond what happens with this decision is, how does this play with the electorate in Louisiana? He was on our show, Mark, and he said that he thought he was leading the state in the direction that most Louisianians wanted.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised with that. It's certainly, he's leading them in the direction that most Louisianians who vote would want to go. You can't argue that. So.
And there is a presidential election in 138 days, and Donald Trump still has not announced his running mate, and Jeff Landry could very well be on the list of potentials. It would seem unlikely for him to be chosen, but stranger things have happened. Remember when the aforementioned George H.W. Bush chose Dan Quayle out of nowhere, out of nowhere, and Quayle didn't help him, but of course Bush ended up winning 40 states against Michael Stanley Dukakis, who lost by 7 million votes, the same number of votes that Donald Trump lost to Joe Biden by. We've got a debate in 7 days, and of course next week when we talk with Mark, it'll be debate time. But what is going to be in store with the octogenarian president and the septuagenarian, soon-to-be octogenarian opponent in Donald Trump?
Well, I imagine there's going to be a lot of discussion about criminal indictments and criminal convictions. There's also going to be a good deal of discussion about abortion and in vitro fertilization, I suspect. Joe Biden is not going to start preparing for this until tomorrow, but at Camp David. But that's what I think will be the main issues that are coming out. I believe energy is also going to be an issue, but we'll have to see about that. But it should be an entertaining hour or so.
70 million watched the first one last time, and I suspect American people will be interested in this, and they should be. Now, yesterday, the front page of the Picayune and the Advocate had a story from Mark saying about this time last year, U.S. Representative Garrett Graves was one of the most powerful people in Congress, meeting at the White House to negotiate deep budget cuts while trying to keep the federal government afloat. The Baton Rouge Republican was poised to become the next chair of the powerful House Transportation Committee. He'd sponsored a key portion of the Republican majority's centerpiece legislation aimed at increasing oil and gas production. And then, as we know, Kevin McCarthy was sacked as Speaker, and Garrett Graves was his right-hand man. And Garrett Graves apparently was giving very tepid support to Steve Scalise as the successor to Kevin McCarthy. And he made a lot of political moves last year that didn't play in Louisiana, including endorsing Stephen Wagesback for governor over Jeff Landry. And ultimately, his thanks was to lose his congressional seat. Well, there is an opening now, and the speculation at Louis this morning was that Landry might very well run for the Public Service Commission seat being vacated by Craig Green, who says he will not seek re-election. That election also is on November 5th. That would seem to be a landing spot for Graves, who I would think would win almost by acclamation if he wants it. But would he want to be a PSC member, Mark?
I don't know. We've never discussed the PSC in talking to him, but that was an interesting. I mean, I saw when Dr. Green withdrew and was wondering what that was all about. It is in his wheelhouse, in Graves' wheelhouse, and that he loves to get down in the weeds and argue about, you know, this weed versus that weed. And that is what the Public Service Commission is about. I mean, they do the broad kind of brush strokes, but, are our rates going up or are they going down? But it's all of the stuff that goes into that that is way in the weeds, and that would seem, you know, just what Graves loves to do.
Well, and it's a six-year term. So if he were elected, he could potentially run for the U.S. Senate against Cassidy, and even if he lost, he'd still be a PSC member. He could run for governor against Jeff Landry in 3 years, and if he lost, he would still have his PSC seat. So he gives him a lot of options if he chooses to go in that direction.
And remember, historically, there's been a lot of our governors came out of the PSC board and people who ran for governor as well, even though more of them recently have come out of Congress.
Well, John McKithen,
Huey Long,
John McKithen, Kathleen Blanco was a PSC member. And of course, right. Lewis Lambert was almost governor, and he was running from the PSC when he lost by fewer than 10,000 votes to David Connor Treen. 877-217-5757. David in Atlanta. David, you're on. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Ballot, Russia can never defeat the United States militarily. The only way Russia could defeat this country is destroy the economy. Donald Trump's plan to eliminate the federal income tax for corporations and individuals and replace it with tariffs, and he thinks the exporter pays the tariff, the American business people and taxpayers and citizens will pay the tariff. According to most economists, it would add like $5,300 of taxes to moderate and low-income people.
All right. Trump has purportedly made that recommendation, and it's one of those things that he throws up every now and then, and people, I think you got to take him at his word. It's something he thinks might be a good idea. He loves tariffs. And in the old days, Mark, you and I remember Ronald Reagan hated tariffs. It was... It was something Republicans didn't like at all, and now Donald Trump is believing that tariffs can solve all the economic woes of the United States. It is a departure from what was doctrinaire back in the day.
Well, there's been a lot of departures from what was doctrinaire back in the day. I think that that Reagan has been replaced by Trump as kind of the leader, the guiding light of the Republican Party, and that's very clear, I think. So, you know, tariffs, I mean, there's a number of things, and that's just one of them.
Well, and it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out and whether the American people will really care. It seems to be a race that will likely be decided by most voters based on whether they like Donald Trump or like Joe Biden or dislike either of them. And Trump is one of those people, as we know. He has intense passion from his followers and intense hatred from those who are against him. And turnout will likely be high again, and we'll talk about the election. If you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. More Talk Louisiana after this. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we will talk some more about national politics, and there's some issues that, of course, are near and dear to our listeners. If you'd like to chime in, 877-217-5757. But do have some people who wanted Mark's take on what Governor Landry did yesterday. As Patrick Wall and Ashley White report in The Advocate, he took a victory lap as he signed a series of education bills that he promised will transform schooling in our state. The Dream Big package of nearly 20 bills impacts the landscape of K-12 education, puts the focus back on students, according to the governor. The new laws would send more public tax dollars to private schools, and also, as a part of that, as we mentioned before, require public schools to display the Ten Commandments and bar talk about gender identity or sexual orientation in school. So this was a sweeping package, Mark, and the governor, he went big on education, and he got very little pushback from a compliant legislature. And once again, really no surprise here, but how will this play long term, if you could make a guess?
If I could make a guess, I imagine that it'll be popular among the people who vote in Louisiana, but not among the entire state. The teachers' unions are still relatively strong in the state. Now, up here, it's not really the Ten Commandments kind of flooded over. When I was looking at it, it was like kind of like an also-ran, you know, with the public money for private schools, which is something that the Republicans have been pushing since the Jindal administration, and the Don't Say Gay bill, which is something that they've been jumping on really since DeSantis brought it up a few years ago. And that seemed to take a back seat. It was just a, you know, and also kind of paragraph in the stories up here. The focus was all on the Ten Commandments.
Well, President Biden this week granted far-reaching new protections for hundreds of thousands of immigrants who have been living in the country illegally for years but are married to American citizens. Under the new policy, 500,000 undocumented spouses will be shielded from the deportation laws and be given a pathway to citizenship and the ability to work legally in the United States. It is being ballyhooed by those who support it and criticized by those who oppose it as the most expansive action to protect immigrants since Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, was enacted 12 years ago to protect those who came to the United States as children. Mark, immigration will be a huge issue. It's really amazing how this is just one that just keeps on going, and the Republicans, of course, are talking about it as much as they can.
Well, yeah, because it's an issue in which President Biden is vulnerable on. And maybe I see things too politically, but I mean, I think that is the key point here, because they, as you recall, that they came out with a sweeping of the Senate. Wanted to pass a sweeping immigration bill, but they backed off when President Trump said he was against it. And he wanted to keep that as an issue during this election. What Biden has been doing is trying to add to things that were in that bill by executive order, and he's trying to the way that DACA was kind of became part of the law. Because it was like a decade old when Trump tried to remove it. He's trying the same thing with this allowing the married person who is an immigrant to stay in the country until they deal with his asylum question.
877-217-5757. Dan downtown. Dan, you're on with Mark Ballard.
Good morning. Mr. Ballard. Given the 7 to 8 billion people in the world who are not Christians, do you think educated politicians like Landry don't really believe Christianity has cornered the truth on the afterlife, but are just pandering to the less educated, perhaps easily led voters?
Well, again, that was a very leading question, but certainly the...
Go ahead.
Certainly the Supreme Court has over time come to the conclusion that that when we talk about freedom from religion, that means freedom from these type of bills. But we have a new Supreme Court. We have a new Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal. And so that may change, and it'll be a huge monumental shift when it does. The other thing is that as it was political is that there is a significant proportion of the Republican Party that is evangelical Protestants, and they vote on this issue, which is a major issue among the more evangelical Protestant churches, and so they pander. That's a verb you can use, but they were also answering the requests of their constituency.
877-217-5757 is your number. Still time to get in with Mark. Mark Ballard with us, and James in Metairie, you have the floor. Hi, James.
Hi, Jim. Good morning. Good morning, Mark. You know, these worthless feel-good laws that Louisiana politicians thrust upon us. You know, last year it was putting up posters with "In God We Trust" in the classrooms. Well, what's that done to reduce crime? Remember, every $20 bill used to purchase cocaine has "In God We Trust" on that bill. And by the way, in a national level, the GOP stands now for a gang of panderers. For example, Representative Paul Gosar wants to put Trump's photo or image on $500 bills. What they won't do to catch up to Trump.
Well, and James, last time we talked about this, are you still a Republican?
I am, Jim. I'm a Republican in name only. I'm in the resistance of the Republican Party, the Never Trumpers, and I hope that this movement will prevail in November, of course. Mm-hmm.
A few months ago, I saw the Reverend Jimmy Swaggart, who's still doing very well on Bluebonnet Boulevard here in Baton Rouge at 89, and he told me that on his birthday, Donald Trump sent him a $100 bill, and Trump signed the bill. I didn't have the heart to ask Brother Swaggart if the bill was real, but at any rate, we're big on praising God, and I think that's wonderful. But is the government the right place to do it, Mark?
Yeah, I guess we should be shocked that there is politicking going on as we go into the November elections. And I think to some extent, but not quite as much, the Democrats are also pandering to their constituency, and which would be, you know, with the student loan debt forgiveness, for instance, the attempts to modify the immigration rules and deal with it on the border. Those are and green energy. Those are steps towards pandering, if we're going to use that verb, to Democrats, just the same as these bills that they're passing on Capitol Hill and in Baton Rouge are aimed at giving the constituents what they want so that they'll come out and vote again in what is it, however many weeks it is until November the 5th.
A story that is front page from Emily Woodruff in The Advocate today. Over a half dozen bills and resolutions related to vaccination sailed through the legislative session, and most have been signed by Governor Landry. Two still await his signature, which is expected. This so-called anti-vaccine movement, once promoted as a panacea, is promoted by what Emily terms a fringe cohort becoming more mainstream in Louisiana, causing concern among doctors and public health officials who worry it's eroding decades of health policy and will result in more disease and death. So, Mark, this is another one that's out of the playbook, the anti-Fauci playbook that plays pretty well in some circles.
Okay, well, keeping in mind that both of my children are in healthcare, so I may be jaded on this response. But I think that, you know, that's correct, that the small groups of anti-vaxxers and anti-maskers were able to exploit social media to create a movement that in the long run is not going to be helpful for the health of America. And again, pointing out that both of my children are well paid in the healthcare industry. So.
Well, the Louisiana judges can now sentence certain sex offenders to surgical castration. Governor Landry signed that bill. Offenders who receive a sentence like this may refuse the procedure, in which they would face an additional 3 to 5 years in prison. The bill was sponsored by a Democrat from Baton Rouge, Senate Bill 371 by Regina Barrow. It received bipartisan support. But once again, Mark, as you know, there are a few guffaws in other parts of the country, probably in the Beltway, about what in the world are they doing in Louisiana right now?
There are many guffaws about that. We need to point out that Senator Barrow, who is liberal on many things, is not liberal on crime and is not liberal on abortion. And so that's not a surprise that she would come up with this. When I was in Texas, they had tried to do the similar thing. And so this would have been about, I don't know, 20 years ago. And the guffaws had them pull back from it because they realized that, oh, wait, this is just terrible. It was never going to pass muster in the courts. But it sounds good, you know, so.
Well, the law does require a medical expert to determine whether an offender can be safely castrated. For those of us of a certain gender, it doesn't sound like a pleasant procedure.
Well, I think it's chemical as opposed to, you know.
No, this one is surgical.
It's like getting out of surgical.
It's okay. Surgical, so. but the offender has the chance to not do it, but would face an additional 3 to 5 years in prison. So what a choice. What a choice, Mark Ballard. But it's always an honor and pleasure to talk with you, and we shall reconvene next week if things go according to plan. I hope you have a great week, and thanks for joining us.
You too. Bye.
Until tomorrow, for Robin Dow, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.